Blog Talk Radio.
Cowards try to change our lives, change the things they despise in America. But heroes, fueled by freedom, that unalienable right to be, came to rescue the injured, rescue the innocent, rescue these truths we hold to be. Self-evident.
They went down into that crater, in that fiery hell, and sacrificed their lives. Steel and stone, sweat and heartache. Now it stands once again for freedom. So call it freedom. Call it freedom.
And a very good afternoon and an outstanding weekend to you once again. Jason Hawes here on a Sunday. What in the world am I doing here on a Sunday afternoon? I don't know. You'll have to tell me. No one, absolutely no one, is more confused than what I am. But anyway, that's not entirely true. I have an explanation for why I'm here, even though confusion is, quite honestly, my standard state of being, but I do have a reason why I'm here, which I'll get into on a Sunday instead of a Saturday. But anyway, I am here today, June 26th, 2016. Hope you are all doing well. Hope you've had a great week. And at this point, doing a show today, the weekend closer to being over than kind of just starting or being maybe halfway through, but hopefully you've had a great and relaxing weekend as well for those of you who can and do use your weekends to relax, sometimes after a hectic week and before the start of even a more hectic week in some cases. But the chat room is open, even though it was kind of loading rather slowly, but it has loaded and it is open if you're out there listening live and if you want to sign in there and say anything. And the call-in line, if you're listening live, is 347-989-8387 as well. Now, like I said, I'm here today on the odd Sunday because I do these shows on my day off from work, which is typically Saturday. And we had I guess you could call it an event or an occurrence at work this week. Our newest driver had, I can kind of see why he was hired, and at the same time, I kind of don't know why he was hired, because he was initially brought in to kind of cover the vacation of somebody. And then he was hired on beyond that and scheduled to work only 3 days a week, Mondays, Fridays, and Saturdays. And that may, in fact, be why he quit. He may have wanted more hours and more work than that. But anyway, he scheduled to work on Fridays, and he did not show up Friday. So the assumption was that he quit. Probably after that, he was done regardless. But did not show up Friday, and that would have left our store with only one driver on Saturday, and basically nobody wanted to work Saturday, including me, but I was asked by our store manager if I wanted to work Saturday and take Sunday off, and I said, well, yeah, I guess I'll do that, because I'm a helpful sort, and I like to help out, whether it's an employer or whether it's another human being. I like to think that I like to help people out when they're in a bind. So I worked all day yesterday, and had today off, and actually, unless they worked something else out, they were driverless today at our store. So I'm Sundays are always so dead anyway that it probably didn't matter a great deal, but it'd be interesting to go in tomorrow and find out exactly how the day went. A reminder as well, along those same lines, that next Saturday, it'll probably be the same kind of thing. I'll probably wind up doing a show on Sunday, because next Saturday I will be off work, and even if they want me or hope that I will actually work next Saturday, it's an impossibility, which I will have to tell them, because I am going to the wedding of a friend on Saturday. And it's interesting, next Saturday is also my birthday, and my mom and dad, as much as they absolutely hate me apparently, they're never here for my birthday, they're awful, awful parents, I kid. But no, they around the 4th of July, that my mom and dad have been square dancing for some period of time, for several years now, and around the 4th of July, they always go to this square dance event out in Branson, Missouri, and they actually celebrated my birthday, the three of us, I guess, supposedly celebrated my birthday last night, and I was reminded that I probably should figure out some type of a wedding gift to get for the couple to be. I don't even know the husband. I have not even met him. I've known the wife or wife-to-be for about 5-6 years now. But regardless, hopefully with some gift in hand, I will be headed to their wedding next Saturday. So, and with that, there will be no show next Saturday. There will be no working for me next Saturday. So it'll probably be the same type of thing, doing a show Sunday, 1 week from today, actually, next weekend. So with that said, and with that in mind, and with all of that meandering nonsense out of the way, getting into the topic and the articles and the stories and all of the lovely commentary that I wanted to provide to you today, a kind of threefold, three-pronged, kind of a tripod show today, if you will, with subjects being immigration and the recent Supreme Court decision on Obama's amnesty, also getting into some Donald Trump news, and I wanted to get certainly into probably the biggest news, at least certainly once we got to the end of the week, which is the Brexit with Britain, the citizens of Britain and of the UK electing to pull out of the European Union. And obviously there's been all sorts of a fallout, and some people would say scaremongering ever since that event as well, and even leading up to it. But that'll actually probably be the last thing that I talk about today. And I wanted to start with actually this immigration case, this immigration decision from the Supreme Court. This occurred, when did it occur? I want to say midweek, maybe early week. This article from WorldNet Daily was 3 or 4 days ago, but I recall when the decision was made, so to speak, if you can even call it a decision, which you probably know how the justices voted or ruled. If you don't, I'll certainly get to that. But when this news came out that the Supreme Court had basically blocked Obama's executive amnesty, or at least one component of it, I was first informed of that at work. The lovely counter people at our store sometimes are as irresponsible as what I am during their downtime and start looking for news stories and so forth on the internet. But I was told by actually a quite a good friend of mine at this store, even though he's in his 60s, I believe. He may be 60 exactly, or 61. So he's about 20 years older than I am, but he's still quite a good friend, a good Christian man. Was looking at the Drudge Report or something and pointed out to me that the Supreme Court had ruled against Barack Obama, according to, again, the story and the headline. And when that was revealed to me at the time, I was like, huh, okay, well, I've got to go back to work now, which, you know, and not to throw anyone under the bus or lead anyone to believe that I am this super, super incredibly committed worker, although I certainly try to be. But as said, I'll look for news stories and so forth during my day as well. But, you know, it was kind of in one ear, out the other, back to work. And then as I continued to hear about the story and continued to read comments on the Internet, and I know that Ted Cruz, who, of course, I have a lot of respect for, and in this particular article, not only a lot of respect, but I voted for Ted Cruz, but in this particular article, Jay Sekulow, from the ACLJ, who, of course, I have massive, massive respect for as well. But everybody was basically on our side of things was painting this as this great victory. Ted Cruz called it a victory, I believe, for common sense and the rule of law. And, you know, I am not a pessimist by any stretch of the imagination, or certainly try not to be. But I am a realist, and I don't know, when you look at this, if we can really call this a victory. Now, this particular article from the WorldNet Daily, WND exclusive by Bob Unruh, who I believe is maybe one of the editors there, one of the main people, certainly, Supreme Court amnesty decision, and here we go, quote, victory for separation of powers, also, end quote, this is a major blow to President Obama. And basically, this revolved around Obama's plan to delay deportation for up to 5 million illegal aliens. And this actually did occur on Thursday when the Supreme Court reached this decision. And again, called a victory for the unique American concept of separation of powers, which Unruh then elaborates. The legislative branch, of course, writes the law, including changes to existing laws, and the executive branch enforces them. This executive branch, of course, enforces the law as they see fit and enforces the laws that they like while ignoring the laws that they don't like in many cases. But anyway, that is the way that we were set up constitutionally as a government. The Supreme Court refused to rescue Obama's de facto amnesty, which had been put on hold by a federal judge in Texas. The order later was affirmed, by the Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Even though, Unruh writes, even though Obama confessed numerous times he didn't have the authority to change the law, he attempted exactly that when his administration issued orders in 2014 that would allow millions of illegal aliens to remain in the country. And here we have the ACLJ, American Center for Law and Justice, was one of the organizations that entered the fray when Obama fought back after his changes to the law were put on hold. And Jay Sekulow, ACLJ chief counsel, said this is a major blow to President Obama and an important victory for the separation of powers. And apparently the ACLJ filed a friend of the court brief on behalf of nearly 340,000 Americans in the case. But this is why, again, realistically speaking, I'm not going to trumpet this as a victory. Will I take it? Should we as conservatives and as Americans who value the rule of law take it? Absolutely. But this was a 4-4 tie on the Supreme Court. It was basically another punt. It was basically take a criminal case. To make a comparison, take a criminal case in which you have a what would seem to be no doubt a guilty murderer standing before you to have his or her fate decided by the jury, and yet the jury, two or three juror members, can't come to the conclusion that that person is guilty. Well, that's a hung jury, in that particular case, the case is, of course, thrown out. And that's basically what this was. This was a hung jury, if you will, and the case was thrown out. Now, it being thrown out, it means that the lower court decision stands, so if you want to call that a victory in some sense, I suppose you can do that. But I mean, look, and I haven't seen how the justices voted, but I think we can probably 100% make a guess that the ones who voted against it were Justices Alito, John Roberts, Clarence Thomas, and probably Anthony Kennedy. And the justices who likely voted for it were Breyer, Stephen Breyer, also, of course, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Elena Kagan, and Sonia Sotomayor. This was basically a party line vote. If I had to lay odds, and I think I would be pretty safe in laying these odds, that this was, if you will, a party line vote in the Supreme Court. And this is the problem that we face. And even in this article, you know, you have Democrats who are quoted, including Barack Obama. As it says here, reacting to the court's vote Thursday, Obama said he was disappointed it was, quote, unable to reach a decision, which he's actually basically right. I mean, you can hate him, you can despise his policies, you can be against him in every sense of the word. That's what this was. The Supreme Court was unable to reach a decision. And again, this is kind of the rub. Said he looked forward to the confirmation of a ninth justice to, quote, break the tie in the case. He then, of course, used that to blast Republicans for not considering his nominee, Merrick Garland, saying they have refused to do their, quote, most basic of jobs under the Constitution. I don't know necessarily if that's their most basic of jobs. I think they have quite a few other duties as well under the Constitution, which, as the article points out, actually is open on when and how Supreme Court nominees are considered. And we know that soon-to-be Democrat Senate leader, either majority or minority, Chuck Schumer, was more than happy to rip into Ted Cruz, Mitch McConnell, and anyone else. And we usually don't defend Mitch McConnell, by the way, but happy to rip into any Republican who wanted to hold off on confirming any nominee until after the election. And we know that Chuck Schumer, back in 2007, 2008, was saying that no nominees, no appointments of no presidential appointments by George W. Bush should be confirmed by the Democratic Senate. No appointments should be confirmed until after the next presidential election. So again, it's hypocrisy full on display. But they are using this. Obama is using it. Harry Reid is using it. Harry Reid, by the way, I didn't post this. You want to talk hypocrisy on display, not to get off the subject, but Harry Reid was once a supporter of the NRA. I didn't post this on my or on the American Faith Today Facebook page. I actually posted it on my page or my timeline. But Harry Reid, he voted against the assault weapons ban on a couple of occasions. He once held a B rating, which isn't great, but for a Democrat is like an A plus rating. He once held a B rating with the NRA. He once was endorsed, maybe more than once, was endorsed and received donations from the NRA. And basically, when the NRA stopped endorsing him and stopped donating to his campaign, then Harry Reid decided, I don't like the NRA anymore. But anyway, they are using this to say that this, of course, is all the Republicans' fault. This is all the Senate's fault. The Republican senators who are too mean, who are too negligent, too delinquent in their duties to confirm Merrick Garland or to go ahead and put him on the Supreme Court. It makes a nice political talking point for the Democrats. But the big thing here is the fact that you've got four justices on the Supreme Court who are completely happy with a president, as long as it's a Democrat or a liberal progressive president, with a president going outside of the bounds and the limits of the Constitution to just basically make whatever law he wants to make whatever changes to law he wants to make. They are absolutely fine with that. Half of the Supreme Court is actually failing. Obama wants to rip into the Republicans in the Senate. Half of the Supreme Court is literally failing in their constitutional duty because they are more than happy to ignore the Constitution if it suits the progressive cause, if it helps further the mission, so to speak, whether that's fairness or whatever, they are more than happy to say, who cares about the Constitution? It's about the cause. And that's basically how they voted. When you consider, again, that the president, at least at various times, saying, I don't have the constitutional authority to do this, and then he goes ahead and does it. And so, no, this was not a repudiation of Obama by the Supreme Court. I would like to think that it was. I would like to say that it was, but it wasn't. And it unfortunately does show just what type of a dilemma we really are in here. When you have half the Supreme Court already who are just that, again, sold out to cause, not the Constitution, but to cause. I'm reminded, not to get off the subject again, but Marilyn Mosby in Baltimore talking about some cause or something in the Freddie Gray thing when that first happened. But that's what these people are all about, is their cause, not the country, not the Constitution, and not the betterments or representing all Americans, but furthering their cause. And again, half the Supreme Court at this moment is in that camp, and that does make this presidential election quite important. I'm not going to say that it does not. We certainly don't want to see Hillary Clinton elected to the Supreme Court. That'll work. We don't want to see Hillary Clinton elected to the presidency and nominating appointees to the Supreme Court. But for those who have total faith and total trust in Donald Trump's presumptive or assumed hypothetical Supreme Court nominees, and I understand that Donald Trump released, of course, a list of 10, 11, 12 Supreme Court justices that he would nominate. He did waver on that. He said, I will nominate people from this list, which was not compiled by him, by the way. It was compiled, I believe, by the Heritage Foundation and some other people. But he said, this will be the list. Then he goes on Sean Hannity and says, well, this will be the list, or people kind of like that, or people in that realm, or however he put it. But, you know, the thing with Trump, and again, I understand at this point especially, and this is a segue into the next topic, which is Donald Trump. The thing with Trump is he is not ideologically rooted. He is not grounded in the Constitution. He is not founded in conservatism. He does not necessarily share these beliefs in his core. I certainly do not believe that. And there are actually some people who think that that's great, that we have this guy who is an outsider, who is someone who's not political or not a politician, that he is just 100% for the people and this and that. And they, of course, are willing to overlook any gaffes, any mistakes, and he's certainly made some big ones. They're willing to overlook those because of his lack of political experience. Personally, I think, and, you know, don't get me wrong here. I'm somebody, to me, Hillary Clinton has been disqualified for a long time from, getting the presidency, being elected into the Oval Office. And I've said it several times on this show. The big thing, I mean, you can talk about Benghazi, and obviously that is huge, and actually the big thing is connected with Benghazi. But you can talk about Benghazi, you can talk about the Clinton Foundation, you can talk about email scandals, and you can talk about deleted emails and insecure servers and enemies of the nation hacking into her server and all of that. If you want to say any or all of that disqualifies her, I would agree with you. My big thing, as I've always said or have said numerous times, was when she stood in front of or in the presence of those parents, those family members of the people who were killed at Benghazi, and said, we're going to go after that filmmaker. We're going to make sure that filmmaker is arrested. which he was, of course, nothing more than a scapegoat. The film had nothing to do with the Benghazi attack, but just the idea that a person in our government who then would want to be president and possibly be elected president would have such little regard for the First Amendment of the Constitution, that disqualifies him. And in my book, Trump is disqualified because he is a farce. He's a farce as a conservative. He's a farce as a Republican. He's a farce as a candidate. And he's a dolt. Now, that's my opinion. Sorry. Take it, leave it, agree with it, disagree with it. But anyway, the point being that he doesn't have these well-grounded, ingrained, deep beliefs in the same principles that many of us do. And, of course, he flip-flops and sways in the wind. He's a guy who basically is of the mindset, if I could analyze him or make any kind of, judgment of him, he's a guy who basically is about the ratings. He's about publicity. He's about attention. He will say something absolutely ridiculous or something controversial to get people talking for a few days, a few weeks, whatever, to have it marinate for a while in the media. And then when pressure comes on him in one way or another, or when somebody asks him, well, did you really mean that? I mean, that sounds extreme. He'll say, well, no, I didn't really mean it that way. It was a suggestion, or it was taken out of context, or it's something that's open for negotiation, or what have you. Or he'll just yell at the media and say, oh, you guys are lying about me. And, of course, man, we know the media does lie. That's certainly true. But, of course, his supporters will say, yeah, the media, they hate him. So, of course, and they get behind him even more. But just kind of quickly here, I posted this on the American Faith Today Facebook page, a couple of things that, again, that are core elements of what have been core elements of his campaign that, surprise, surprise, he's backtracking on, flip-flopping on, shifting on. One of them, which he's shifted on numerous times, is this ban on Muslims. When earlier in this campaign, back when we still had Republican debates, he, of course, came out and said that we need to ban all Muslims from entering the country for a while until we figure this out. And he then shifted on that and said, well, look, I'm not the president. And so that was really just a suggestion. That's all it was, just a suggestion. I wasn't really saying that that was policy. I can't make policy. I'm not the president. And then after Pulse Nightclub, which, of course, was horrific, but he doubles down, or he goes back to it and says, we have to ban all Muslims from entering this country until we figure out what's going on. Well, now he again has shifted and has said, well, you know, I'm not saying ban all Muslims from entering the country. I would say ban all Muslims from entering the country who are from countries that have a problem with terrorism, where there's terrorism going on, or they sponsor terrorism, or they encourage and aid and abet terrorism. Ban those Muslims from those countries. When he was asked for specifics on it, he, of course, did not give any specifics. And, this is something, by the way, that as I was thinking back to what I'd heard along the way, this was a policy or a suggestion, if you will, of Ted Cruz. I seem to recall during these debates that when Donald Trump was saying ban all Muslims, Cruz made some type of a joke, I think, regarding FDR's grandfather, saying that not all, FDR's grandfather once said, not all Democrats are horse thieves, but all horse thieves are Democrats. And he got a little bit of a chuckle, but the point he was making was that not all Muslims are terrorists, but all terrorists, or many terrorists, of course, are Muslim. And he was saying, and he said then, that if we wanted to ban anyone, if we wanted to make sure and be tougher with anyone, not necessarily all Muslims everywhere, but Muslims who come from these terror-ridden, terror-plagued, terror-enabling countries. And somebody even added that he's apparently introduced legislation in the Senate to basically do that. So, this really isn't even a Donald Trump, I don't think, a Donald Trump original idea. Now, he's also backtracked a bit on mass deportations, which I believe this was, I don't have it in front of me, but I believe this was from Red State. He's backtracked on mass deportations of illegal immigrants. He was interviewed by, I want to say, Bloomberg. Again, I'm going from memory here. And he said, no, I'm not going to say, or I wouldn't say that we're going to have mass deportations. Well, he did say that at one point and even talked about, as the article pointed out, that having some type of an immigration force to deport all of the illegals in the country. Now he's saying, no, we're going to do this humane. I have a bigger heart than many people. He apparently, from what I could gather of the article, even told the person from Bloomberg interviewing him, well, I have a bigger heart than you, and we're going to do this in a humane and a human way. But again, he's not consistent. He's not grounded in anything. He basically just throws things out that sound good to him at the moment. And, you know, if he needs to back away from it later or if he needs to revise it later, he will. And the people that he has helping him, you've got Ben Carson. Who, Ben Carson, how many Christians, how many conservatives, how many people once thought that Ben Carson was an attractive candidate, perhaps a great hope in the Republican or conservative movement? Ben Carson going out there and saying that, well, maybe we can put the Second Amendment on the table and see if it's something that we need to keep. I mean, he said that. And this is a guy, of course, who's endorsed Trump. This is a guy who's a surrogate for Trump. In some ways, he's an extension, maybe an unofficial extension, but an extension of his campaign. Going around saying, yeah, let's see if we need to keep the Second Amendment. Maybe we don't. But anyway, now, turning things on the same subject, but I don't want to say humorous because it's not humorous. First of all, I hope that it occurred. I really do. But there's been something that's come out here, and it was put out there by James Dobson, who, of course, from Focus on the Family, was president of Focus on the Family, now about 80 years old. I'm not going to comment on all of his teachings. Actually, I don't know all of his teachings, but certainly a very revered, a very well-regarded, a very well-known individual in the evangelical movement or in evangelical circles, who said that he was told by someone that Donald Trump recently came to Christ. And, you know, again, I hope this is true. But I'm trying to backtrack and find the article here. This from Red State as well, from Susan Wright, pointing out that James Dobson saying that, I believe that Donald Trump really made a commitment, but he's a baby Christian. We all need to be praying for him, especially if there's a possibility that he will be elected. He said, I think that he's open. He doesn't know our language. He really doesn't. And he refers a lot to religion and not much to faith and belief. And again, like Susan Wright, she says, I say that, you know, you hope this is true. But at some point, too, you have to watch the man. You have to see if there's any changes in him. You have to see if there's any, if he has truly come to Christ. And by the way, this is a man who said all along that he was a Christian, so that makes it a little dubious or a little bit certainly something that you have to be skeptical of. I mean, this was a man who told Chris Cuomo that he was perhaps being audited by the IRS because he was a strong Christian. Well, now, according to James Dobson, he's recently come to Christ. And so, again, let's hope so. Let's even pray so. But at the same time, do we see any evidence of that? So far, I don't believe that we do. But, you know, I'll have to move on. I'll say let's hope so. But don't get fooled by everything either. You know, even if you want something to happen, even if you want badly to believe in somebody, use your brain, you know, use your discernment, you know, ask if this seems real. You know, every person on death row becomes a Christian, or many of them do, just before they're executed. And in some cases, maybe in several cases, they do have a legitimate turnabout and a legitimate profession of faith, a legitimate coming to of the faith. But in other cases, too, it's kind of a poor me kind of thing. Maybe we shouldn't execute him now. Now, I almost forgot about this. Again, I've got to move on to Brexit. I've got less than 10 minutes or about 10 minutes. I posted this on the American Faith Today Facebook page. We were talking about it in a forum before I started the show. Michael Harrington, a guy who crunches numbers during every election, I believe, is basically, now he wants this independently verified. He's not saying this is definitive, but he has basically presented the case over at redstate.com that it was Democrats who pretty much secured the nomination or presumptive nomination for Donald Trump. He used 2000 and 2008 numbers and elections and primaries as baselines. He crunched the numbers however he did. He explains it a little bit in the comments at the Red State article. The numbers that he's come up with are about 3.3 million Republicans voted for Trump and about 12 million Democrats voted for Trump. And this included open primaries. This included the state of Oregon, which is not an open primary, but he found, or he points to the fact, that 110,000 voters in Oregon changed their registration. His calculations are approximately 80,000 of the 110,000 voted for the perceived weakest candidates. He said, they chose our presidential candidate. This was in Oregon specifically. They chose our presidential candidate, they chose our U.S. Senate candidate, and they chose our governor candidate. Ironically, they did not vote strongly down ticket, including for Secretary of State, and this assisted in my efforts to calculate the percentage who actually voted versus those who did not. Again, it's a very interesting piece. It's not necessarily definitive, but what it shows certainly is troubling, and it's something that I think many of us kind of believed all along the way was that Donald Trump was being handpicked by Democrats to be our nominee. I know there's going to be Trump people out there who think that he's converted those Democrats. That remains to be seen, whether these are converts or whether these are people who were literally trying to sabotage the GOP primary. Now, like I said, I got to move on to Brexit here. Brexit, in my opinion, it's a huge deal. You know, it really is. It was apparently they had 72% voter turnout for the Brexit vote in the UK, and it was about 52% to 48% that, of course, chose to leave the European Union. Now, as a Christian, as someone who doesn't consider himself to be a Bible teacher or a prophecy expert, but I do think this possibly could be, I was kind of asked by somebody when, again, I posted on my Facebook timeline, do I think this is the deadly wound or a head wound? No, I don't think it is the deadly wound. I don't think we're that far along yet. I think we're pretty far along. I don't think we're that far along, but I think it is something that could potentially, it's certainly something to watch, and it certainly is something that could speed up prophecy. They're already speculating about dominoes, even more dominoes falling out of the European Union. There's talk that France, that the Netherlands, that Austria, that Finland, and that Hungary might all want out of the European Union. I wanted to go to some prophecy on this in the remaining time. And again, I have what I consider to be a very good rundown from Brandon T. Ward at World's Event in the Bible. I posted it on my timeline. I posted it on the American Faith Today timeline. I'd invite anyone to go there and to read that article. It says Britain has not pushed out the globalist. And I think that he's right. Like I said, the one area where I kind of disagree a little bit is I think that this is something that could lead to more things down the road. And I don't know necessarily that he's not saying that or doesn't believe that. I think it's a little bit bigger maybe than what he does, but certainly time will see and time will tell. Now, I want to go to Daniel here, chapter 7, verse 3. And four great beasts came up from this sea, diverse one from another. Now these beasts, as you will find in verse 17, are kings, or you might call them kingdoms. Four great beasts, four kings, four kingdoms that come up from the sea. Prophetically, you can find it in Revelation, the sea is the sea of peoples, the sea of nations, the world's population. You got the first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth and made stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. Again, this is a man-made system. This is man-run. Verse 5, and behold, another beast, a second, like to a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, arise, devour much flesh. Now, the bear, I agree with interpretations that this is Russia. And Russia certainly had its moment in the sun as the USSR. They will rise up again, and they kind of are rising up again, even though it may not entirely look like it. Verse 6, after this I beheld, and lo, another, like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. And again, this, I believe, are Satan's children, which many of us call the Kenites, that are integral in operating this one-world system. And then, for time's sake, the fourth beast, basically, I believe, is the one-world system. But what you will find here in verse 7 is that it had 10 horns. And you do see that in verse 8 that you have three of the first horns, three kings, if you will, plucked up by the roots, and behold, in his horn were eyes like the eyes of, and basically you have the Antichrist, Satan, rising from this system, from this one-world system. You have the removal of three kings. Now we haven't gotten to that point yet. Again, so I will agree that this is not the deadly wound. We have not gotten to that point yet. One area that I did want to say that I maybe disagree, even with some of my Shepherd's Chapel fellow students, if you will, just something I kind of even recently settled upon today. Now, there are some people who have this interpretation as well. If you turn to Revelation chapter 13, again, this beast system, I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the names of blasphemy. Now, as Pastor Arnold Murray would often teach, seven heads, well, we have seven continents around the world, so these seven heads could be seven continents, which, again, just emphasize that this will be a worldwide system. We're not quite there yet in its completion. Some have even said it won't ever get totally completed, at least by man, but we're not quite to that end point yet, but we are globalized, of course, in many ways. But when it talks about a deadly wound to the head of this system, again, keep in mind there are seven heads to this system, seven heads, seven continents, so we might be talking about a fatal wound to an entire continent, if you will, not necessarily an agency of the United Nations, not necessarily one country, but perhaps one continent. And I do think that the European continent, when you look at what's going on with the European Union, all the unsettlement that is now taking place financially, some would say that that is manipulated, orchestrated, intentional. But nevertheless, the upheaval, the concern, financially, again, the possibility that more countries may leave the European Union, that could be something, perhaps now, that could have a rather consequential effect on the entire continent of Europe. And when you look at the Muslim immigration and what that has done to much of Europe, causing problems throughout that entire continent, Europe could, in fact, be a head to watch, prophetically speaking. Now, that's just my thought. Certainly, we will have to watch indeed as events continue to unfold before our very eyes. It's certainly a very active time to be living. We do thank God that He has revealed prophecy through His Word, and certainly we ask for Him to help reveal prophecy to us as well. But keep your eyes open, keep a watch on what continues.